Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Infants on Thrones. I'm your host, Scott, and today we have a very special guest.
I'm Dr. Jeff Meldrum. I'm a professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University in Pocatello, Idaho.
In part one of this two-part episode, we discuss Dr. Meldrum's excellent book, Evolution in Mormonism, A Quest for Understanding. As a biology professor, Dr. Meldrum teaches courses on evolution, but he's also an active, believing member of the LDS Church.
Like I said, I hope I don't get a call from my stake president, Bishop here. Be kind with the editing, yeah.
We discuss his books, his experience, and how he helps his students attempt to reconcile LDS theology with a genuine scientific understanding of evolution. In the second episode of this interview, we discuss with Dr. Meldrum his other area of scholarship, Bigfoot. That's right, Dr. Meldrum is a world-renowned Bigfoot expert. He's been on NPR.
Watch Legend Meets Science. He joins us from Idaho. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Meldrum.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Dr. Jeff Meldrum is, in my opinion, the most credible of all the Bigfoot believers.
Coast to Coast AM.
I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, The Hunt for Bigfoot, a classic Coast to Coast show in the making. But here's what's happening. Traces of radioactive...
And countless Discovery Channel specials. Now, before you go assuming that Dr. Meldrum is a fringy lunatic...
We, as LDS, should expect aliens to resemble us.
Keep in mind that he's a scientist who is actually investigating a claim. He's trying to prove something. He's pretty convinced that Bigfoot is the real deal.
If you want to say 99% certain.
So personally, you're quite certain that it exists.
Quite certain that it exists, yeah.
We talk about a current project of his...
And this thing zips down there like a mosquito and stings the Sasquatch in the derriere and implants this subdermal transmitter that'll last for a couple weeks, maybe. You know.
And also discuss whether or not Bigfoot has really came. If you're LDS and you've never heard that connection before, you're in for a special treat. So buckle up and enjoy part one.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
Today, I mostly want to talk about your book, Evolution and Mormonism, A Quest for Understanding. But
right.
You're probably better well known, at least on the Discovery Channel, for your studies and your scholarship and your interest in Bigfoot. Is that fair to say?
That is. That would be fair to say, yes.
If anybody watches a Discovery Channel or similar type show on Bigfoot, you're usually on those. I've seen quite a few of them myself, and it seems like you're always there.
Yeah, very frequently. I'm one of the few academics who has taken an open role, a visible role in investigating and vetting the evidence relating to the legend of Sasquatch, yes.
Okay, and I want to get into that, but first, if we can, let's talk about your book.
Okay.
Here. You were one of the co-authors.
That's correct.
With Trent Stevens and Peterson.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. What was the impetus for writing the book, or why did you feel that it was an important book or a necessary book to write? What was your motivation?
Well, it was for the students. Being LDS, Trent Stevens and I were constantly assailed with questions from students. I teach a section of, or two sections of organic evolution myself. And so here at ISU, the student body is about 50 to 55% LDS. And so it was a question that was constantly cropping up, and students were asking us, looking to us as LDS scholars, asking how did we reconcile? And while we could share our own personal positions, our personal opinions, and how we've arrived at those, there was virtually no literature to refer the students to, or very little. The last publication by an LDS scholar was by Frank Salisbury from Ricks, and entitled The Creation. And that was in 1975. And quite honestly, there were portions of that were rather misleading and inaccurate summaries, particularly of the paleoanthropological data. But obviously he was working with what he had at the time. When you consider what has transpired in the last quarter century, virtually 80, I'd estimate 80% of the hominid fossil record has been discovered. We have the capacity to sequence entire genomes and the means to analyze those phylogenetically. The, quote, missing data of evolution, the evolutionary developmental data, or evo-devo, as it's called, has finally come to the fore, and we understand much more about how genomes translate into phenotypes and how body plans are established in major taxonomic groups. So there was so much information that was missing from any of the books that had been written previously by LDS authors, let alone scholars who had training in the biological or natural sciences, that we felt it was important to address that and to also gauge and convey any change in position or stance by the general authorities as far as the official position of the church vis-a-vis human origins, human biological origins, and the action of evolution in prehistory.
Sure. So you have students then who are coming to the university, they're taking your courses, they've been raised LDS, and they're coming in, probably a lot of them, with a pretty traditional view on the church's truth position regarding evolution. Is that fair to say?
Well, in a way, and this is where it kind of gets sticky, is they often come into the university with very scant training in their high school biology courses in evolution, and often having received a lot of disinformation from their well-intentioned but probably poorly informed seminary teachers in this regard. And so there are notions which are assumed to be doctrinal that are perpetuated and even sometimes slip in through the curriculum committee, the church curriculum committee, into our curricular materials. I have to sit on my hands every time, every 4 years when the Old Testament is discussed, and we launch into Genesis, and I've learned to only open my mouth if a extremely egregious remark is made, either from the members of the ward or more significantly from the gospel doctrine teacher.
And I can imagine your frustration with that. I was when I was struggling with this, one of the things that I looked to was the CES manual on the Old Testament, which I'm sure you're familiar with. There's about a 7-page section in there, and I actually checked this morning. It's 2013, and there's still, you know, like 7 or 8 pages in there just railing on how Darwinian evolution didn't happen, and it's all this, basically non-scientific explanation for why this macroevolution basically didn't happen.
One of the times I did interject a query first and then a comment was when the gospel doctrine teacher launched into an exposition on the pillars of faith, paradisaical creation, fall, and the atonement. And I interrupted him and I raised my hand. I said, "Are you reading from the manual or are you shooting from the hip here?" And he held the manual up and turned it around. There was the diagram with the three pillars of faith. And so I pointed out, I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but that's not doctrinal. The notion of the earth having been created in a paradisaical state, with immortality prevailing, with no death before the fall of Adam, is not a doctrinal statement, in spite of the fact that many people, including many general authorities, will possibly tell you that it is, based on their experience and their understanding and background." That's one point we go to great lengths to elaborate upon, and we sought clarification in our appeal to the authorities, you know, beginning with our respective bishops. We worked our way right up through the stake presidency, and then the area president, and then received a response from the church office building. And basically it was a mimeographed or a Xeroxed paragraph from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, of all places. And it was a very circumspect statement that, that was, you know, left a lot open to interpretation. So the point was, there is no official position vis-a-vis the modus operandi of the preparation of the physical body as a tabernacle for the spirit children of Heavenly Father.
Yeah, and maybe before we go any further, I just want to make sure for our listeners' sake that we're clear about what we're talking about here. It's been surprising for me how many people I've run into who, although they understand the idea of evolution in a general sense, they probably don't grasp
right.
Exactly what that means in a precise sense. People will confuse it with a biogenesis. They'll confuse it with cosmology.
Right.
You know, they think evolution is the Big Bang, or they think that speciation just happens all of a sudden. So just to clarify what we're talking about, we're not talking about the origin of life. We're not talking about, you're talking about the fall of Adam and death before the fall, which is obviously necessary for the evolutionary process.
Exactly.
But in terms of what evolution itself is discussing, it must be difficult as a professor in dealing with those religious ideas to kind of parse them out from each other. Do you have that struggle at all?
Well, oh, certainly. And yes, definitions are a major stumbling block or hurdle to make sure that when we communicate, we're actually talking about and thinking about the same thing. Because, you know, you could do a simple poll of a room full of people and ask them to, in just a few words, say what they thought of or what came to mind when you uttered the word evolution. And you would find many of the things that you mentioned, you know, that humans evolved from apes, the Big Bang, all these different things, the origin of life and so on. And when we're talking about at least Darwinian evolution, it can be boiled down into a very succinct definition that there are more offspring produced than are necessary to replace the parentage. Amongst those offspring, there is variation that is introduced naturally through mutation and recombination, and that there's a struggle for existence, that there's a limited resources. So all of that superfluous population isn't going to survive. And those that have varied traits that lend some advantage will be more likely to survive, to pass on those heritable traits to the next generation. And that repeated generation after generation leads inexorably to the accumulation of differences with the restriction of gene flow, and the process of speciation goes on. But the key there is differential survival. So if nothing's dying, there can be no evolution. And so if the notion, it boils down to this one simple proposition, if the notion that there was no death on this planet until Adam partook of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, then we can just, as Latter-day Saints, we would be obliged to throw out Darwinism, to throw out the notion of evolution through time. And so that is an important point. And I that's why it, for me, it's very critical that the membership understand, at least those who are concerned. You know, your banker, your real estate agent probably couldn't care less unless he has a personal interest in this. And people are sometimes curious why I'm so concerned about it. And I say, well, this is my career. This is what I do for a living. This is what I teach in the classroom. You know, this is what I see around me in nature. So it's a real issue for me. And as an Latter-day Saint, it does in part pivot on that precept. I would be forced to make a decision if the First Presidency came out tomorrow and said, thus saith the Lord, there was no death before the fall of Adam. Adam introduced mortality into the world. The earth fell from its paradisaical state, and we now find it in this terrestrial condition. That would put me at odds with the scientific data versus a doctrinal declaration.
Sure. So for you, the I guess that's a pretty, common, understanding in, for most members, I think, in terms of how they think about the fall and what effects, right. what were the effects of the fall. You know, if somebody put that out there in a Sunday school lesson, it brought death into the world would probably be written up on the chalkboard shortly thereafter. So I guess if you could explain a little bit how you get there, doctrinally from the traditional LDS view that there is, and I'm going to say traditional based on the people's understanding, in a general sense, at least in terms of how I've experienced it in the last 30 or so years.
Sure.
How do you go from, you know, the verses, and I know this is in your book, but explain if you could how you get there from the doctrine of how people understand it, what's in the scriptures and,
right.
and all of that to parsing that out or getting to the point where, that's, you know, doctrinally feasible.
Well, right. I mean, and unless a person is willing to acknowledge that notion of the fall introducing death into the world for all creatures, unless they're willing to abandon that or to recognize that that's not doctrinal, that is the biggest stumbling block. A lot of times, and I, you know, myself went through this, this process, but Second Nephi is, one that comes to mind that had Adam and Eve not partaken of the fruit, then they would have remained in the state in which they were created. You know, the question then becomes, what state were they in? And what state were all things created? I mean, what would they have remained as? If you assume that they were created in an immortal state, then that's a problem. But if you assume that they were created in mortality, then you could simply, for me, it's easy to look at that passage, and it simply means that the plan of God would have been thwarted. Adam and Eve would have remained in a state of innocence, living in the Garden of Eden, having access to the Tree of Life. Therefore, and as we're told, the Tree of Life bestows immortality. That's what bestows immortality. If they were created immortal, what would have been the purpose of the Tree of Life? Now, this is kind of, it's almost like asking questions, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? If you are caught up in a literal reading of these passages rather than the sentiment that's conveyed in the temple, which is Adam and Eve simply are representatives of all of us. You know, when those two people go up to the altar, role-playing the characters of Adam and Eve, they represent all of us as if at the altar. In other words, that whole story is setting up a drama that conveys my relationship to Jehovah, my making covenants with Jehovah. It doesn't really matter what Adam and Eve did. What matters is what I do. And if you see it as a literary treatment of the covenant-based plan of salvation, then you don't have to strain after every gnat and every little speck of apparent controversy. But on the other hand, I mean, because we obviously in our book, we actually kind of go in both directions. Dr. Stevens, took a more literal interpretation of Genesis than I typically personally, embrace. And so he went through and made, efforts to show how much depends on your reading and interpretation of those passages. And so he goes through and in that chapter, he was primarily responsible for the kind of running narrative of how one could reconcile the description in Genesis to the conditions in a terrestrial world where the garden was set apart as a separate and distinct place, a location. The whole world wasn't a paradise. Eden was the paradise. And when Adam and Eve fell, I mean, if you read it that way, when Adam and Eve fell, they were thrust out of the garden, out of paradise, and into a world that was in a terrestrial state already. where all of those conditions has prevailed were in effect throughout the creative process. So now my the other way to look at that, if you're not hung up on a strict genealogy that Old Testament genealogy that traces our roots right back to Adam and Eve as two distinct individuals, and I know that's a tough one because there's a lot of doctrine relating to the role of Adam as Michael. And again, if that's to be taken literally, then my notion that those two are rather figurative individuals is perhaps problematic.
I think one of the most attractive elements, or one of the most interesting parts about evolution to me, is just the awe and the wonder and the enormity of the process.
Yeah.
So for me, if there's anything, and I think it's two-sided, but there's something beautiful about thinking that these traits are being passed on.
Well, sure.
And then become something more than just a random change. If they were a random or chaotic change in the first place, you know, 1,000 generations or 10,000 generations later, they're now becoming something useful and something beneficial to the species. But then there's, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and that kind of touches on a common misconception, this notion that God wouldn't use a random process. Well, mutation is random, but natural selection is not. Natural selection is very purposeful in the sense that it eliminates maladapted individuals and promotes the existence of adapted individuals within a species. And so you're right. I mean, your remarks immediately reminded me of Darwin's words, where he said there is grandeur in this view of life. I mean, he was very awestruck by the notion that here was a mechanism that could start from this very simple life form, and from it unfold or evolve all these magnificent variety and diversity of life that we have on our planet.
Do you see anything on the other side of that equation in terms of if death is required, and death is a big part of it here, and you could call them probably mistakes, isn't a very scientific word, but these kind of adaptations that are not favorable for a species, statistically there are going to be many more of those kinds of adaptations or mutations than there are ones that would be beneficial to a species. Is my understanding correct?
Sure, I think you're right. Yeah. So
okay. Yeah, so I think a lot of, at least in terms of discussions that I've had, people have pushed back on the idea of evolution as being a godly process because they'll see it as more destructive. If it's 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 of, you know, traits that have to be created and then die off, or diseases that are caused, it seems to be more, you know, it seems to be out of whack in terms of something where if a deity were all powerful and could create a being like ourselves, why create things in us that cause harm? I think, you know, wisdom teeth might be a good one to focus on. Very painful, unnecessary, potentially deadly, you know, not useful organ in the body, but something that's vestigial, clearly evolutionary related. How would you see that in terms of it being a process of creation?
Well, a lot of it hinges on the assumption that you made or you stated, and that was if God is all-powerful, if he is omnipotent. You know, there's a lot of, we talk a lot of times about law and about God operating within natural laws. Now, is God the author of those laws, or is he constrained by eternal laws, be they as simple as, you know, the forces that hold atoms together? Must he work within the bounds of certain fundamental principles that govern the very nature of our universe, or the multiverses, which is another fun area of speculation and theoretical physics and cosmology. You know, and some people, again, the hackles are raised if you question that omnipotence, omniscience and omnipresence. Well, you know, where did that trilogy come from? That came from other denominations, wrestle to try to define what God is. Our perception of God as a resurrected immortal being is very different. One who has gone through a process, an evolutionary process, if you will. And, John Woodsow even compared the plan of exaltation to evolution, in which those individuals who proved worthy were the only who were afforded the privilege of passing on those traits inherit or acquired, to their offspring, their spirit children, as our father and mother have done to us. Now, when you talk about evolution being a wasteful or a destructive process, and so would God employ such a thing? Well, God is part of a process that saw a third of his children damned, halted in their progression, banished from his presence. You know, if you want to compare evolution in or describe evolution in those terms, we could turn it right around and talk about the plan of salvation, that it's not the most efficient, the most optimal, perhaps. You know, Satan, that was the difference. Satan's plan was to optimize. I'll bring you all back. You'll just have to be my, you know, completely indebted to me, and I'll exert my influence over you. But that possibility didn't even exist. You know, if that scenario is accurately portrayed, it's always been mystifying to me how audacious Satan must have been to think that he could derail the system, that he could do an end run about a system that apparently stretched back into the eternities. There never was a time when there wasn't a father and a son, you know, Joseph tells us. And so, for some reason, Satan felt that he could short-circuit that plan. But it seems that there wasn't even that possibility. It really wasn't a choice. It was just the ultimatum was carried out, and Satan was banished along with all those who were seduced by his very persuasiveness. But, you know, a third of our brothers and sisters were lost in the process. And if we look at the few numbers that are suggested to us will actually make it to the highest degree of the celestial kingdom and have the privilege of being husband and wife and procreate to have eternal lives, you know, throughout eternity, that's a small fraction. That's a small fraction of the offspring of deity. So I think the comparison's very apropos there.
So we've looked at, or we've discussed probably the biggest premise that you would need, which is the Adam, no death before the fall portion of it. Let's look at the other end of the spectrum, which is that within Mormonism, there's this idea that God, that we were created in God's image,
right.
And that God has a physical body, right. Flesh and bones, and perhaps doesn't go so far to say that, you know, he has the exact same physiological characteristics as of us, but I think that's generally the understanding,
right?
Or the depiction. So there are questions of if we are evolving, if humans have been on this constant path of evolution for the last several billion years since life began.
Right.
How does it work that we are becoming more like our creator, who happens to be a bipedal?
Right.
Hominid,
right.
With 10 fingers and 10 toes, and is the same height and has hair in the same places. You're an expert on morphology and bipedalism.
Right.
So maybe you can explain your view on how that would be.
Right. Well, you know, and there's been a lot of interesting conversations and musings on both sides of the aisle regarding that sort of thing. Stephen Jay Gould used to like to, and Carl Sagan often talked along these lines, and were of the opinion, Gould was of the opinion, if Earth time were a movie and you could rewind the tape back to the start, and let it play afresh, the outcome, the plot would unfold in an entirely different way. And I think that's a real overstatement. I mean, one of the things that has really emerged from more recent evolutionary thought, and including some of this evo-devo, for example, is that there are tremendous constraints on the potential outcomes. Richard Dawkins, in one of his seminars, talked about the fact that, leaning a little bit towards Gould's position, but he said, if we were to discover life on another planet that he had evolved independently, he said, I would predict that there would be carnivores, and there would be herbivores. There would probably be plants and animals of these types. There would be parasites. He said, but the appearance of individual types of animals would probably vary from what we see here on the planet today. Now, there's so many remarkable examples, though, of the convergence, even more than Dawkins, I think, allows. A classic example that we use in the classroom in evolution is to show the placental mammals arrayed with their ecological vicars in amongst the marsupial mammals in the southern hemisphere, particularly Australia. And these two lineages were separated long ago, and their evolution proceeded independently. But yet we see placental wolves and marsupial wolves, placental cats, and an interesting, almost looking like a placental cat. We see animals that dig in the ground, animals that fly, animals that hop, and so on down the line. And their body forms are remarkably similar. And if you asked someone who didn't know better, which of these, pair these up, which are most closely related to one another, they would never guess that all of the marsupials are more closely related to one another than anyone is to any placental mammal, and vice versa. So I think that, the notion that the outcome is completely unforeseeable, unpredictable, is an overstatement, is a stretch. I think that statistically, as you pointed out, there are going to be rough, predictable outcomes. There are going to be certain guilds of animals. And the process, and I'm not excluding the occasional perturbation by a creator. If you can manipulate a physical environment and thereby exert distinctive selection pressures, perhaps at a pivotal time in the evolutionary history of a lineage. But I think the outcome of upright bipedal primates was essentially inevitable. Now, some may take that as a bit of a stretch, but I think that once that process is set in motion, it would take very little in the way of manipulation or of tweaking of the stage in order to come up with a cast of characters that are very similar to what we find today on this planet. And that was the point, is, that process led to a point of preparing a tabernacle that was suitable for to house the spirit children of deity. It's interesting. One little point. If you want to dote on the details, the possible implications of the details, Adam wasn't created in the Garden of Eden. He was created and then introduced into the Garden of Eden. And then if Eve was created subsequently, we've been told explicitly that the description of her creation from Adam's rib was figurative. But, if you want to dote on the details, why wouldn't God have created Adam in the paradise, rather out in what I suggest is other conditions, where other conditions were prevailing? The conditions that set the rest of the world apart from the unique conditions within the Garden of Eden, where you could find the tree of life that imbued immortality, if that story is to be taken at least semi-literally.
So in your view then, I'm just trying to extrapolate your point then. What you're saying is, the conditions that have led to our body,
right,
they would essentially be, apart from maybe an environmental difference, like an abundance of oxygen or something like that, that previously prevailed on the planet and led to these, megafauna and that sort of thing. But But otherwise, if we were to find life on another planet, you might expect there to be a bipedal, upright walking hominid that looks relatively similar to us. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. If we're to believe the scriptures that suggest that Christ's atonement was infinite and that on all these other worlds they have become begotten sons and daughters unto him, then unless they're, and if they were, quote, created in his image, then yes, we as LDS should expect aliens to resemble us, at least in the broadest brush strokes. I mean, I think we could allow for the types of anatomical variation we see amongst various racial populations and subpopulations on the planet today. And those are kind of extreme in some instances. So sure, I think, so if we can reconcile an evolutionary process to produce a body that resembles, our concept of an anthropomorphic God today here on this planet, we should, as LDS, be quite comfortable or expect that same process to have been repeated on worlds without number.
And maybe you could explain your take on the flood.
A local event that impacted Noah and his immediate family, and
so the idea of a global flood that killed every living thing, but
I can't.
What was on the boat?
I can't see that justified. I mean, it's based on what we understand about the distribution of species and biogeography and evolutionary history and so forth. There's just absolutely no way to accommodate a global flood that annihilated. And you know, when you start to push that, it becomes absurd. I mean, it really literally becomes absurd. So you either have to appeal to some fantastical, supernatural process, like God placed all these animals in a coma, or you have to allow for a tremendous amount of evolution from the representative pairs of species that disembarked from the ark after the fact. I mean, it's just, the notion of a global flood is just really impossible to accommodate given the data, the understanding we have of the distribution of life on the planet and so forth.
Well, General Conference is coming up, so I'm hoping to hear a General Authority, use a Darwinian evolution analogy to the church and throw out the global flood. So what do you, where do you see, you've been seeing this for decades, obviously, and you've seen students come and go, for many years. So do you see attitudes changing within the church in regards to evolution on any kind of a big level? There was a survey a few years back by the Pew Forum. And they did a distribution of different religions and the degree to which they believed in that organic evolution was the explanation for, the species on the planet.
Right.
I think maybe you've seen that, but I think Mormons were somewhere around 40 or 44% in terms of the number that believed it. Do you think that's on the increase, or where do you see the church? Where do you see the general authorities going on this, the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years?
Right. Well, first of all, you have to be careful with those kind of polls because they usually present a question just as you stated it. And so how do you answer that? You know, I might be a little bit torn because I, in addition to my scientific background, I hold religious convictions as well. And so do you answer that, conveying your religious conviction that there is a deity at the helm, there's a deity that sees over this process or whatever, or do you risk being labeled amongst the atheists or agnostics by stating that evolution is the process by which species came into existence? See, the problem is that they don't make a distinction. They don't have the philosophical sophistry to make the distinction between an approximate cause and the final cause in the explanations. And so in preparing a question like that. But that having been said, it's really hard to gauge, because just when I think that there is some glimmer that there is a more progressive attitude or more a more realistic attitude vis-a-vis the data of evolution, the fact of evolution, quite frankly, that things are evolving. There's no getting around that unless you want to stick your head in a hole. And then there's suddenly this precipitous backsliding when one of the brethren will make a ridiculous comment, in general conference. You know, I had a student, and I may get myself in trouble. I may be called, let's take precedent for saying this, but, I had a student, several students come in after one of our recent general conferences, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was Elder Nelson, who made a comment, a quip about the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And they came in and said, what did you think of that? And I said, well, just pause for a minute. Now, think about how he said that. He said, of course it didn't, these things didn't happen with a Big Bang. And then he paused and he sneered. He smiled a smirky smile, waiting for the reaction of the audience.
Yet, some people erroneously think that these marvelous physical attributes happened by chance or resulted from a Big Bang somewhere. Ask yourself, could an explosion in a printing shop produce a dictionary? The likelihood is most remote. But if so, it could never heal its own torn pages or reproduce its own newer editions.
It was a derogatory remark towards those who, of course it didn't happen by the Big Bang. And I said, now you tell me, is that how the Holy Spirit teaches? Through belittlement, through cynicism. And they said, well, no. And I said, and then he went on and he cited one of the most cliche examples from creation science. We would better assume that an explosion in a print shop would produce a dictionary or an encyclopedia. I mean, that's frankly a very silly analogy to draw. And it simply conveys an ignorance of the life sciences and the processes of living organisms. And so, and I don't mean to be, with all due respect to Elder Nelson and the office which he holds, I think he crossed the boundaries of that office by making such a statement. And every once in a while, there'll be a quip like that, you know. Oh, well, of course, hen's eggs don't hatch out crocodiles. Or, there was another one recently. And I'm just amazed, you know. Sometimes there was a time back when I was at BYU and Bruce R. McConkie gave his seven deadly heresies talk. And I was one of those who had less intelligence than a dirt clod in the primordial swamp. Who believed in organic evolution, or who held to organic evolutionism as a mechanism, if you will, a creative mechanism by which these processes were carried out. But in the published version of that talk, it was heavily edited and the most egregious statements were removed. But that was not publicized very widely. You know, unless you bought BYU speeches, you wouldn't know. And in fact, many of my professors didn't know. I had a professor who was rather antagonistic towards evolution. He passed out a mimeographed transcript of the oral talk given by Bruce R. McConkie. So I, the next day, brought in a photocopy of the published version of the talk with all of the changes highlighted. And he was really taken aback. He had no idea. So every time the conference report comes out after such a questionable comment, I quickly flip the pages open to see if they've edited it. And lately they haven't been.
I think Elder Packer's talk from a few years ago, there was a part they took out about homosexuality not being, innate, basically. Yeah. They changed the word from it being a tendency to it being a temptation.
Yeah.
So being something internal versus something external. Right. But that's
another,
interesting.
Yeah, there's another topic that has some interesting biological underpinnings as well. But
So in terms of progress or what you see, where you see the church going, I mean, it seems to me like they're in a really tough spot because there is this inexorable march in society towards evolution being more and more accepted. Mm-hmm. I see that even, I think I see that among friends and people who are, you know, in their 20s, 30s, there's a big generational difference. But at the same time, the church curriculum and kind of the common notions in the church seem to be fairly fixed. So I wonder how, because I think you're exactly right. I think the only way to reconcile it is through the way that you're saying, and unless the church embraces some of those ideas, it's just going to be just pushed against a wall when it comes to those ideas. So I wonder how that's going to shake out in the next, you know, 10, 20 years.
Well, yeah, and it's been interesting. I mean, I've seen individuals who have struggled with this and who, upon learning of the lack of unanimity amongst the brethren on the subject and upon learning of the process by which doctrinal positions seem to be arrived at, begin to question other doctrinal positions. And that's, you know, that's a slippery slope, obviously. And that's one that the brethren are vigorously attempting to prevent the membership from approaching. And I don't know to what extent, you know, I really don't. I really don't know to what extent there is a conscious effort, at least in the case of evolution, to continue to promote the positions that were somewhat unofficially canonized by the likes of Joseph Fielding Smith, Bruce R. McConkie, Markey Peterson, and Joseph Fielding McConkie in his recent book Answers. I don't know how much that's the case versus just really a lack of appreciation of the fundamentals, tenets of the apparent controversy. Since we mentioned Bruce R. McConkie, Elder McConkie published or delivered a symposium, presentation at, I think it was a Book of Mormon symposium held on the BYU campus, and then there was a publication that ensued, but it was, I think it was entitled The Law and the Light, and I'm caught a little flat-footed here. But The Law and the Light, and in this instance, it had an editorial disclaimer attached to the beginning of the talk or the transcript, his published version, and it basically said that he was taking responsibility, personal responsibility, for the opinions expressed herein, and they didn't necessarily represent doctrinal positions of the church. And I think that's probably one of the first times that a publication by a general authority was so qualified. And I don't know if that came at his behest or at the first president's behest or at the editor's behest. But he takes a very strong anti-evolution position. And again, one of his fundamental objections is you can't have bloodlines that extend back to a pre-human ancestor. See, and he's pushing the notion, you know, that we can't be saved without our ancestors. There has to be this eternal chain, and you can't, and for some reason, he thinks you can't have a bloodline that goes back to some being that wasn't quickened by the spirit of a child of our Father and Mother in Heaven. And I mean, I guess I'm at a loss as to how he comes to that conclusion. I mean, it's not doctrinal. Certainly, it's his own opinion. It's his own working out. You know, at one time when I in a gospel doctrine class, I was brash enough to say, to point out that this or that utterance by this or that authority was not a doctrinal, did not reflect a doctrinal position of the church. And the rebut by someone on the front row was, well, I think that their experience and their dealings with the, you know, with the hierarchy of the church gives them a lot more authority to express their opinion than you do. And I said, oh, really? Well, on certain matters, I would have to agree with you. I said, but in this matter, I must disagree. And I would assert that I have many more years of experience on this topic, at least as it relates to the biological underpinnings of this topic, than does this or that general authority. So, now back to your question. I'm sorry I rambled around. You know, I really don't. Because like I said, just when you think that there's been a silencing, you know, with the passing of Bruce R. McConkie, Elder Packer seemed to, be much less outspoken on the subject, much less frequently, speaking out. And, but then all of a sudden, you know, he makes a statement like that, in The Law and the Light. And then every once in a while, there'll be a quip, from the pulpit of the general authority. And if we're, you know, as we're told, presumably those, well, you know, we're told to rely on the utterances of the prophets as if they were the Savior speaking. You know, and that gets me in trouble sometimes too, because just because it's stated from the pulpit at conference, it's not necessarily doctrinal. And here's a case in point. As a young, maybe naive graduate student, when Bruce R. McConkie gave his rather stinging remarks about evolution, and he made the quip about hen's eggs and crocodiles. And for those who aren't familiar, he related an experience when their family was incubating hen's eggs, and one of the small children was peering at these eggs, anxious to see what would hatch out. And he saw this as a learning moment. And so he queried, you know, what will come out of these crocodiles? And the little girl chuckled and says, oh no, daddy, it'll be hens. And he said, even a toddler knows that likes beget like, you know, going back to that creationist notion that there has been no change since things were created with the indelible stamp of the Creator in the Garden of Eden.
Well, and I think a big part of that too is that just the time frame, looking at it on a basically geological time frame of
right.
hundreds of thousands or millions of years,
right.
this kind of change is much, much easier to accept.
Sure.
If you're someone who looks at it on a time frame of the last 6,000 years.
Or even a lifetime, you know, if your experience in writing Genesis is based on a lifetime of observation, of course goats beget goats and chickens beget chickens. But, you know, you're absolutely right. If you're able to transpose to a time scale of millions or billions of years, then the change over time, you know, and I emphasize this to my students, you know, there are two aspects of the system. We had to have a system that could transmit genetic information from one generation to the next with some fidelity, because if it works for us, it'll work for them if conditions remain stable. You know, if the old adage, if it works, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I guess that's it. But on the other hand, we all know that the environment never stays completely the same, that there are always changes. There's succession in the plants and the habitat, and environmental changes, climatic changes, you know. And so in the face of that inexorable change, there had to be enough wobble in the system. And that's why we see that not all offspring of a single individual look identical to one another. But there's a variation. I mean, why else would there be variation? You know, you could ask that as just a rhetorical thought question to someone who, you know, holds on to a literal interpretation of likes beget like. If likes beget like, how come they don't all look like one another?
Sure.
So anyway. But really quickly finish this thought. So as a rather idealistic graduate student, I sent a letter to Elder Packer, and I explained my position, and I challenged him on this point. And I said, you know, how can you betray the trust of a teacher by getting up and saying things that aren't based in doctrine? I says, are you aware of some revelation that has not been shared with the membership? You know, whether it's personal or otherwise, but if it's personal, you know, are you in a position to expound on that from the pulpit without the express permission of the First Presidency? And, I didn't expect to get a response. And about a month or so later, I did get a response. It was very abbreviated. And apparently he had been inundated with similar letters. And, he said he'd held on to my letter at some time intending to answer me in greater depth. But then he got a mimeograph copy of one of his other responses that was being distributed. And he said, since it was obvious we couldn't have a private personal conversation about this, he said, I'm not going to say any more at this time. Well, if he was concerned about a private personal conversation, I think he would have stopped short of saying that at the pulpit in front of the entire membership of the church. But it was within a few months that the Law and the Light talk was delivered. And then subsequently published. And those were the thoughts he was collecting and was intending to answer in more fully. And so I suppose he didn't want that distributed. Not that I would distribute it necessarily, but he didn't want that distributed, openly until he had a chance to finish preparing his presentation, his talk and have that published. But the point is, he acknowledged, and he said in his letter, he said, I felt that since there was so much sophisticated information being delivered in well-produced documentaries about evolution, stating as if it was a fact, he thought he was within his rights to express his opinion on the matter, to offer an alternate opinion. So the point is, he acknowledged to me that he was not teaching doctrine. He was expressing his opinion. And granted, his opinion is valued and certainly carries significant weight, but nevertheless, it was his opinion.
Well, that's it for part one with Dr. Meldrum. Stay tuned next week for part two.